All right, hi everybody, and thank you very much for having me here. It's my first time visiting the Perimeter Institute. I'm looking forward to the talk, and I'm glad I also get to get the chance to give a colloquium this afternoon. So what I'll be talking about are red supergiants. They're one of my primary areas of research as an astronomer, and I'll be specifically looking at our sort of state of understanding of these stars, how we think they work, what some of our outstanding questions are, and how these stars can really serve as a magnifying glass for better understanding stellar theory. So to start off with, I want to acknowledge the group that I'm working with at the University of Washington. This is the postdoc, two grad students and two undergrads who are doing all sorts of awesome work with me. I unfortunately didn't get the chance to feature everything that they're doing in this talk because they're doing quite a lot, but a few people's research does come up throughout the course of the talk and I'll highlight it when it appears. So to start off with, I want to establish what red supergiants really are and what their role is relative to other stars in stellar evolution. So to start that off, I wanted to define this plot, which we'll be seeing a lot of over the course of the talk, because I know that we have a mix of physics and astronomy backgrounds in the room. So this plot is what's known as the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. What it's plotting is temperature along the x-axis and then luminosity along the y-axis. And if we drop a full population of different types of stars on here, you can see a nice scattering of where pretty much any normal star that we know about is going to land. We see hydrogen-fusing stars following the main sequence, this diagonal going from the upper left to the lower right. We see the post-main sequence giant branch for low-mass stars. And then up top, we see supergiants. So red supergiants fall into this category. They're coming from stars that are 8 times the mass of the sun or more and represent the coolest phase of supergiant evolution. So I'll zoom in on that and actually track what these stars are doing. So if we take something like the 20 solar mass star that's depicted up here, that star has been going through its evolution for about 10 million-ish years, fusing hydrogen in its core. When it runs out of hydrogen, it will stop core fusion, and we enter a brief period where the star starts to expand and cool off as it switches from core hydrogen fusion to core helium fusion. When that happens, it moves across the top of the HR diagram incredibly fast, following this equation as a result. Because as the star is cooling off, its luminosity is held quite constant, and as a result, we see it cool off and we see the radius increase dramatically. So it will go from being a blue supergiant to a very brief pit stop as a yellow supergiant. These stars actually only spend about 100,000 years of their entire lives as yellow supergiants. It will then move over to the right side of the HR diagram and begin the red supergiant phase. So red supergiants are the coldest and the physically largest mass of stars that we know about. They're very distinct from red giants, despite the unfortunately similar names. Red supergiants and red giants have very different previous histories. So these stars have higher initial masses, they have shorter lifetimes, they follow very different evolutionary pathways than giant counterparts. This is also either the end phase or an intermediate phase for stellar evolution. So some red supergiants will just die. They will undergo core collapse and produce a core collapse supernova. Others will actually evolve back to the left side and well off the left side of the HR diagram. They start shedding their outer layers and they turn from red supergiants into something called a Wolf-Rayet star, and then we think produce a different type of supernova or perhaps even a gamma ray burst. So the little evolution that I just sort of animated in Keynote can actually be traced with something like this, where we draw out the way that a star moves along the HR diagram over the course of its lifetime. The line that's now been sketched on there is something known as an evolutionary track. What drawing these lets us do is fill an HR diagram with evolutionary tracks for stars with different initial masses. So what's shown here is how we expect a 12 solar mass star, a 15 solar mass, up to a 40 solar mass star, how we expect all of these stars to move on the HR diagram over the course of their lifetimes. And the little region that red supergiants occupy on this diagram is right here. It's the far right extent of these predicted evolutionary tracks. So these are the very coldest stages of the stars. You can see that they slowly get more luminous during their time as red supergiants, and they spend quite a lot of time here. So that was sort of illustrating what it looks like from the outside. As a red supergiant evolves, I also want to take a quick look at the interior of a star like a red supergiant. So this plot is something called the Kippenhahn diagram. And what it's showing you is a almost cross-section. The unit here is mass, it's basically the mass function within the star, and how that changes as a function of time. So the star on the left is on the main sequence. It's fusing hydrogen into helium, which I've color-coded in red. Once it switches from hydrogen fusion in the core to helium fusion in the core, you wind up with hydrogen fusion in a shell and then a very large convective outside layer. And this gives us the red supergiant phase to the right. So that kicks off when helium fusion starts in the core and then continues as the star starts to progress to higher mass fusion, as it starts undergoing carbon fusion and perhaps even later. This is what the interior is doing. I showed you what the exterior is doing. There's a nice animation that I like showing of what happens when we combine these phenomena, because we've described a star that is undergoing helium fusion in its core and has a very large convective envelope. We also talked about the fact that the star is very cold. This does really interesting things to the atmosphere of the star. The atmosphere is very puffed up. The scale height is very dramatic. So if you illustrate what the surface of a star looks, of a red supergiant looks like, you get something like this. So this is an actual simulation showing the convection that's going on in the surface of the star. For our sun, you see these little tiny granules and you barely notice that this is going on. But for something like a red supergiant, we have only a handful of convective cells. Their size is similar to the radius of the star and they're just boiling away. So right from the start, looking at this, you can see that understanding something like the atmosphere of a red supergiant and how this convection works is going to matter because it's giving us brightness variability on the surface of the star. So this is how I usually like to start this sort of thing. Who actually cares about red supergiants? They're cold, they're big, yay, they explode. Why does this actually matter? And I contend that you do, that everybody cares about red supergiants. They're actually a really interesting linchpin phase in stellar evolution. I've listed off just some of the applications that red supergiants are critical for. We need to understand them to understand how massive stars form, how they evolve, how they die, how stars like this affect the composition of the universe chemically. There's interesting nucleosynthesis processes that go on. The list can go on and on. So I'm going to come back to these later and touch on a few sort of key applications that I think are especially interesting. But what I want to do now is back up and look at some of the challenges of red supergiants. We can't just look at this list and go, yay, red supergiants are great, let's use them. I want to look at a few reasons that these stars are intriguing and why they're still a really active area of research. So the first thing I want to touch on is red supergiant temperatures, and I'm bringing the HR diagram with evolutionary tracks on it back. If you look at these tracks, you'll notice something kind of interesting. The red supergiants all land here, and the evolutionary tracks all seem to stop at an almost identical temperature. There's this hard limit where all of the evolutionary tracks hit. To the right of that is a region that we sort of refer to as a forbidden zone on the HR diagram. That vertical line represents something known as the Hayashi limit. So it's a limit on how cold a star is allowed to be while maintaining hydrostatic equilibrium. As you start to cool a star off more and more, you actually run into strange opacity effects in their atmosphere, and it effectively changes how deep into the star you're able to see. So this is telling us that there should be no star that looks colder than about 3,300, 3,500 Kelvin. The problem comes from the fact that this is a theoretical diagram, and for a long time when we actually observed red supergiants and measured their temperatures and plotted them, they all wound up here. So they all seemed to be violating physics. And for a long time, we did the natural thing, I think, for any experimental person to do and blamed everything on the theorists. We're just like, okay, your models must be wrong. This must be a major issue. And we finally decided to step back and take a look at maybe the observations being the problem. Yeah?
As a star cools down, temperature is dropping, so you have this T to the force dependence. Why? So you should drop, I guess.
So what you're not seeing on here is there's that relation that I showed early on that luminosity goes as radius squared times temperature to the fourth. So what I could plot on here, it would be hard to see, but you could imagine drawing lines of constant radius that go roughly like this. So because of how these stars' fuel sources are working, they're not getting any more luminous. They are getting colder. So the way that that's accounted for is that their radii blow up. By the time a star is a red supergiant, it's like 1,500 times the size of our sun. So that's where we're getting the accommodation to balance the equation, since the luminosities do, like, this is real. They stay pretty much completely flat as they leave the main sequence and become red supergiants.
Explanation for why it's so flat? Why is the luminosity so flat?
There is an explanation, and I'm kicking myself for not remembering the exact wording of it right now, but it has to do with what's dictating luminosity, that the fuel source in the core is the primary thing dictating luminosity, and that fuel source doesn't change over the course of that time. You'll notice that they all do get a little more luminous while they're sitting here because the mean molecular weight in their core is going up as they turn hydrogen into helium. During this phase, that changes very little, so there's nothing driving the luminosity up. For lower mass stars, it doesn't look like this at all. They go climbing up the HR diagram because we are seeing a luminosity effect change. Yeah?
If we go back to your cross-section diagram, when you're on the main sequence, is the envelope radiative, is supposed to convective, and that's what's going on?
Yes.
It's becoming convective.
Yeah.
It's really maintaining the heat flow.
Yeah. It has to, I won't remember off the top of my head exactly where it changes, but as the star is shifting from being totally in radiative equilibrium to being partly in, to being somewhat out of it, you see that luminosity evolution as it's illustrated. Any other questions before I keep going? All right, so I think we were at the point where we were blaming everything on theorists and finally changing our minds and realizing we should look at how we were measuring temperatures. So for a long time, we had very rough ways of estimating stars' temperatures. We were looking at color and assuming black body emission. We were sort of taking measurements of a handful of stars that were nearby and trying to apply them to everything. And what we needed was a better tool for measuring red supergiant temperatures. This came about in the early 2000s when groups started publishing really good models of red supergiant atmospheres. So this is an animation of stellar atmospheres for red supergiants as we cool the atmospheres down from 4,000 Kelvin to about 3,400 Kelvin. And you can watch the spectrum change. As we cool off, you see these enormous broad molecular bands showing up in the spectrum. Those are bands of titanium oxide, which is rapidly becoming more abundant in the atmosphere of the star as it gets colder. What that means is that we can see a direct relationship between the strengths of those titanium oxide bands, which we also use to measure spectral type. That's why this is going from a spectral type of K1 to a spectral type of M5. Those bands become a great proxy for temperature. So my very first research project, I did this after my sophomore year in college, was to go observe 75 red supergiants in the Milky Way, use these titanium oxide bands to estimate temperature, and then replot all of them on the HR diagram. And the stars moved from here to here. So the theorists were right, the observations were wrong, and with the help of yet more very valuable theory, we were able to update what we understand about red supergiant temperatures. So this looks perfect and fixed. There are still some problems. This starts to break down in galaxies with different chemical compositions. In galaxies that are very chemically depleted, we aren't quite as good at matching theory and observations. We also have this technique currently limited to optical data. I showed you an optical spectrum of a red supergiant. In the infrared, things don't quite match. Infrared temperatures sometimes suggest that the stars are a little warmer. We're not sure whether this is a fault of one or another diagnostic or a problem of trying to model these stars' atmospheres. Since they're so puffy, their geometry gets difficult to estimate. And getting spectra are also really observationally costly. You have to go after the stars one at a time or in small handfuls using multi-object or fiber spectrographs. So it would be great if we could do this just using colors. It would vastly increase the sample size of stars that we could measure like this. So another challenge is trying to study red supergiants in other galaxies. This is actually a really big appeal of red supergiants because they're so luminous that we can easily detect them in galaxies far beyond the Milky Way. But trying to find that sample and define that sample gets really messy. So to start with, I always do this when I'm talking to anything but a room full of astronomers. I need to explain what I'm about to do to the periodic table. So this is the normal periodic table of elements that we all know and love. This is the astronomer's periodic table. Hydrogen becomes X, helium becomes Y, and everything else becomes Z or metal. So oxygen's a metal. And when we do this, we use the term metallicity. So metallicity is referring to the non-hydrogen and helium chemical composition of a star or a galaxy. So we'll be using this term going forward to refer to everything except hydrogen and helium and how much of it we see in a star or an environment. So If we want to observe a sample of red supergiants in another galaxy, it sounds fairly simple on its face. We want to pick stars that are red and that are really bright, bright enough to be supergiants. And the problem starts when we start defining red. Their color comes from their temperature. So the first thing we want to do is define what range of colors or what range of temperatures we want to look for. That Hayashi limit that I mentioned before shifts to warmer temperatures as we move to lower and lower metallicities. So these are three sets of evolutionary tracks on an HR diagram. The black tracks are at the metallicity of our own Milky Way. The red tracks are at the metallicity of the Large Magellanic Cloud, about half Milky Way metallicity. And the blue tracks are at the metallicity of the Small Magellanic Cloud, so about a quarter of Milky Way metallicity. You can watch the limit, that sort of limit for how cold a star is allowed to get, move to warmer temperatures as metallicity goes down. And this comes from our definition of what the Hayashi limit is. There's more free electrons available at higher metallicity. So this leads to a higher abundance of ionized hydrogen. And ionized hydrogen is the main opacity source in a cold star atmosphere. The opacity, kappa here, actually goes as temperature to the ninth in these stars. So it's almost entirely dependent on temperature. And as we get more ionized hydrogen, the star is going to get cooler. So we need to know exactly what the metallicity of an environment is before we start to pick which stars we want to observe in there. To put it another way, the histogram on the far right is a distribution of spectral subtypes. And I'm sorry that this is so small, but it's a distribution of spectral subtypes for stars in galaxies in our local neighborhood. So we go from the Milky Way on top down to the very low metallicity Wolf-Lundmark-Malat galaxy on the bottom, and we're plotting very warm stars, so K0 subtype red supergiants, down to very cold stars, so M5 subtype supergiants. You notice that as we go, we see way more early type stars at low metallicity, which means we're seeing way more warm stars. The little strip in the middle is also an observational demonstration of this. So this is from a paper by Maria Drought from 2012, and she was looking at red supergiants in the galaxy M33. M33 has a big metallicity gradient. So as you move from the inside to the outside of M33, the metallicity is changing drastically. And you'll notice that as the metallicity drops, as she moves through different regions of the galaxy, the distribution of red supergiants starts to move. It shifts into worse and worse agreement with the evolutionary tracks that are shown here. So what this basically means is that if we want to effectively sample red supergiants in something like a very metal-poor galaxy, we need to look for almost orange supergiants. We need to look at a bluer temperature, a bluer color range than would really work in our galaxy. So we've covered why color is hard. We also want to know what range of luminosities we want to be looking for to study red supergiants elsewhere. I showed the HR diagram before. This now, by the way, has those lines of constant radius, so you can see how the three parameters relate. And it looks sort of easy. It looks like we could just draw a line saying, well, massive stars are 8 solar masses and above. That corresponds to a luminosity of this. So we just cut everything off below 8 solar masses, and there's our luminosity range. This works great because we get all the red supergiants. We also get red giants. We get the very most luminous solar mass stars that are at the sort of luminosity tip of their red giant evolution. So this is a very bad way of grabbing the sample. We get contamination from these stars, and there are a lot of these stars, so understanding the population starts to become a real issue. If you look at a distribution of red supergiants on the HR diagram and look at the evolutionary tracks, it's kind of unclear where we want to put that cutoff. You could just grab everything, but you're getting contamination from red giants. You could be very strict and cut off anything that might be a low mass stellar evolutionary track, like the 7 solar mass track. But then you start missing some of the lower mass red supergiants. You can try and compromise somewhere in the middle. This is about where we wind up drawing the line. But it means that we wind up with incomplete or contaminated samples if we just pick a straight up luminosity cut. And this so far is pretty hard to solve. There's also a lot of other things that are impacting the luminosity range. If we don't know the distance to a star accurately, we'll underestimate or overestimate how bright it is. Metallicity itself also can affect how luminous stars can get. If the star has a lot of circumstellar dust around it, like this one, it could start blanketing emission from the star, and we will be underestimating how luminous it actually is. And a lot of these stars are variable. They will get brighter and dimmer with time, so that makes it even harder to get a definitive luminosity for the star. There are some other tricks, too. If we are grabbing red supergiants, we're going to get contaminants in our sample. And we look at different ways of getting rid of these contaminants. So one sample are foreground dwarfs, red dwarfs in our own Milky Way that are easy to mistake for background bright red supergiants. An interesting way to do this is actually by using their colors. So this is a plot showing the V minus R photometric band color versus the B minus V color. And if you draw this out, the red dwarfs lie along this black distribution while red supergiants pop out here. This actually comes from the result of the stars having very different gravities. We can take advantage of how ridiculously huge the red supergiants are. Because the surface gravity is very different, it impacts the width of spectral lines in the atmosphere, and there are actually so many spectral lines in a cold star that you wind up blanketing out the star and actually changing its color because of the line broadness. So this is one trick. We can also do things like kinematically measure the stars and see if they're moving with the background galaxy that we think they're members of. Foreground giants get harder. We can try to also use kinematics, but the gravities are now similar enough that color effects aren't enough. What we're trying to do now is find spectral lines that are sensitive to the surface gravity of a star and trying to use those as ways of telling the difference between giants and supergiants. So this plot right here is from a paper that I did with a student named Jeff Jennings. It's showing the width of the hydrogen alpha absorption feature as we go through three different stars, a supergiant, a giant, and a dwarf, that have almost the exact same temperature. And you can see that H alpha is actually impacted by surface gravity. There are other lines and other diagnostics that we can maybe use for this sort of thing. This is work that I'm doing with an undergraduate named Brooke DeCenzo, so this is work that's currently in prep. But hopefully we'll get better at distinguishing these.
These are actual observations?
Yes, those are actual spectra.
And, but, so you think the strength of that trough is affected by the surface gravity?
The equivalent width of the feature specifically is what's affected. So what actually happens is you wind up with the 2s state in H alpha is metastable in a non-LTE atmosphere. And the overpopulation, it moves the opposite way that you think. The line is actually broader at lower surface gravities because the overpopulation becomes more severe there, and you wind up with an excessively broad H alpha line. You don't see it in H beta or any of the other hydrogen lines. You do see it in the Paschen lines because it's an effect in N equals 3.
Can you explain it quantitatively, how much it's broadening the surface gravity?
We've tried. The problem is our other means of measuring surface gravity aren't that good. We can do a model fit. We can sort of analytically describe it if we know luminosity and temperature. We have plots where we'll look at surface gravity versus the width of the line. We also looked at radius versus the width of the line because that's what we're really seeing. But right now, we basically have plots saying, look, it goes up as the surface gravity goes down. So I'm hoping that we may have better tools for that in the future. They're also very difficult observations to get. So our sample is still on the order of 20 or 30 right now. We'd love to get more. The last contaminant that I want to talk about are background galaxies. We've talked a lot about stars that are closer to us than red supergiants, but we'll also occasionally pick up background galaxies that appear very red. This can usually be fixed if you just get deep resolved imaging. You can tell that something looks like a fuzzball instead of a star, but sometimes you don't know for sure until you get spectroscopy. So this is an image from a paper that a graduate student working with me, Trevor Dorn Wallenstein, did last year. We were looking for red supergiants that had X-ray signals that might have something like a neutron star or a black hole companion and be undergoing accretion onto the compact object. We found a red object that looked like it was in M31 that was X-ray bright, and we got a spectrum of it, and the spectrum came back like this. It's almost a red supergiant. I was not that familiar with this sort of spectrum when I looked at it, and I started squinting and trying to make it work. What that actually is a quasar spectrum. This is a background galaxy at a redshift of about 0.23, I believe. It just happens to be smack behind M31, so it looks like a red supergiant in M31. So we didn't know that until we actually got a spectrum, and there's plenty of other examples like this to be had. So another challenge that I want to cover with red supergiants is understanding their mass loss. Red supergiants shed an enormous amount of mass from their outer layers as they go through their lives. I showed this star before. This is VY Canis Majoris, a red supergiant in the Milky Way. This is probably one of the most dramatic examples, but you see that immense dust shroud around the star. And understanding how that mass got there and how the star has shed mass is really important to understanding how the star evolves. This is yet another HR diagram, and it's showing the predicted evolution of a 20 solar mass star where we've started to enhance its mass loss rate, MDOT, once it hits the red supergiant phase. So this is its evolution if its mass loss is just a little bit enhanced. Blue shows cranking up the mass loss rate by a factor of 10. Red shows cranking up the mass loss rate by a factor of 25. It gets ridiculous. It starts to look nothing like what you would see for a normal mass loss rate. We'll use observations of these stars to try and predict what they might look like right before they produce supernovae. So knowing where they even are on the HR diagram due to mass loss is really important. Studying this mass loss for a long time has been hard. We've tried to estimate it from things like dust excesses or find correlations between mass loss and luminosity, but the data is pretty limited. So this is a spectrum of a red supergiant that I observed in black, and Overlain is a best fit atmosphere model in red. You'll see there's actually a bunch of excess emission over in the far blue, almost into the near ultraviolet. What we think we're actually seeing there is near ultraviolet emission from a dust reflection nebula around the star. It shows us that there's a lot of dust and that the star probably underwent a lot of mass loss, but it's a pretty minor effect. It doesn't give us a great deal of detail. What we're hoping to start doing now is taking advantage of a tool that a very different subfield in astronomy is using. So this is a famous image of using a coronagraph. This is a coronagraph that's been trained on a star, blocked out the central light from the star, and allowed us to see dim structures around it so we can see things like little nearby exoplanets. Working with Jamie Lomax, who she's currently a postdoc at University of Washington and is moving to the Naval Academy in the fall, we've started using coronagraphs to observe red supergiants. So this is an image using that exact same instrument from the last slide to look at a nearby red supergiant. And you can see that there's this really interesting asymmetric distribution of material around it. This observation is in the infrared. We already got, I think yesterday she emailed me preliminary data on Hubble STIS observations in the optical. So what we're trying to do is get multi-band observations and get a direct look at what the surroundings of this star look like, what the mass that it's lost appears like, what the geometry of it is, and maybe try to back solve from that to the process of mass loss and some of the underlying physics driving why the mass is lost. And then finally, red supergiant evolution in binaries is very messy. Binary evolution, period, is very messy. It can dramatically impact how these stars lose mass, how they evolve, and how they die. So these are plots of the BPAS stellar evolution models. These come out of J.J. Eldridge's group in Auckland. You can look at the evolution of single stars, just normal, no binary companions, and then compare that to the evolution of a star in, I would say, a fairly typical binary system. The stars are somewhat separated. Their mass ratio is not too extreme, but you can still see what happens. These stars, for example, instead of dying as 10 solar mass, red supergiants that started as 10 solar masses, now turn back, get very blue, wind up somewhere over here. Everything about their evolution has changed. It gets worse if you look at something like an extreme binary, stars that start interacting very early on. Their luminosities drop, they get much hotter, they die in a completely different part of the HR diagram. So understanding how many stars are in binaries and what the binary evolution is doing to them is crucial. We shockingly know very little about binary red supergiants. We have a handful of well-observed systems that are interesting, but they're not giving us the full story. So this is a schematic of the red supergiant VV Cephei in the middle. This is an M2 supergiant, and its little B dwarf companion. We got lucky in this case. VV Cephei is an eclipsing binary, so the observer is here, and we're able to watch the B star go behind the star, pop out, go in front. And from that, we can look at things like transmission spectra, look at the chromosphere of the red supergiant. It's all very neat. But this is not strictly an interacting binary. That B star is not impacting the evolution of the red supergiant. It's actually orbiting in the wind of the red supergiant. So it's kind of picking up mass that the star already dropped. It's not driving mass loss on its own. We only know of a handful of systems like this. This is another one to scale. This is Zeta Aurigae. I'll blow it up so we can see it. So this is a K4 red supergiant that, again, has an eclipsing B star binary in it. We have 10, maybe fewer, systems like this that we know of. What we would really like to find, specifically with red supergiants, are systems where we're seeing mass transfer. And we actually think that red supergiants are a crucial ingredient of this. Remember that one of the most interesting things about these stars is their huge radii. This becomes really valuable if you look at a binary system. So these are the equipotential surfaces in the orbital plane of a binary system. Here we have a mass ratio of 2, so the one mass to another mass is a factor of 2. And the Lagrangian points are marked along with the Roche lobe. So you can imagine that what you really need is a star in this system to just get big, to just increase in radius enough to hit L1 and actually kick off mass transfer onto the primary. Red supergiants are amazing at getting huge, so they should be really key ingredients in making systems like this. You can look at the potential wells of that same binary system and see how that's going to go. You can have two stars in a detached binary. You can imagine a semi-detached binary where the larger star has overflowed, has filled its Roche lobe. And then you can imagine a contact binary where you actually get mass transfer back and forth. But we know of no confirmed systems where we see this going on, which is kind of shocking. There are predictions that we should see very large numbers of massive stars in binaries, but we would love to find systems like these. I don't necessarily think this means that the systems don't exist. I just think that they're difficult to observe. So we're working on new techniques for trying to find objects like this. Still, so far we've got detached systems, we have not seen semi-detached, and we have not seen contact when it comes to red supergiants. And this is mostly true, but there is a sort of extreme version of a contact binary or a common envelope binary in red supergiants that I want to cover. So, these are the Thorne-Zhitkov objects that were brought up before. Thorne-Zhitkov objects were, for a long time, a theoretical class of star. And the idea here is that you have a neutron star core that's surrounded by a very large and diffuse envelope. So this is breaking our normal model for how a stable stellar interior can work. Instead of a fusion core, you have a neutron star core. Yet from the outside, this should still look like a normal star. We have two models for how these can form, and both of them count on massive stars in binaries. The first is the idea of one star overflowing its Roche lobe, turning into a red supergiant, and engulfing something like a neutron star companion. The companion is engulfed, falls into the star, and spirals into the core, where it eventually winds up forming a TZO. You can also do this collisionally, which I think is a bit more statistically funky, but also a bit more fun. In this case, you have a red supergiant and a companion star, not a neutron star, in a binary system. The companion will explode as a supernova and form a neutron star, and the supernova kick will send this neutron star flying into its companion. So it implies that the supernova has really amazing aim, but it's actually not quite as absurd as it sounds when you think about how huge red supergiants are, the close binary radius that you would need, and the fact that it wouldn't be that hard to toss a neutron star in the right direction. Either way, these wind up as sort of extreme consequences of contact binary and common envelope evolution. The trick here is that for a long time, TZOs were theoretical. We'd never observed them. And the issue is that they should actually look exactly like red supergiants. That large, diffuse, puffy envelope should appear as a very cold, very massive star. So they look exactly like red supergiants, almost. There's one quirk that we can take advantage of if we look at the interior of the star. So this is a sort of keynote diagram of what a cross-section of a red supergiant would look like. You have the red supergiant surface, you have a convective region in the star, and then you have that helium-fusing core down near the bottom of the screen. If I turn this from a red supergiant into a Thorne-Zhitkov object, there's two key differences. One is the core is now a neutron star. The other is that these are supposed to be the very coldest massive stars that we know about, so their envelopes are completely convective. And this means that the convective region reaches all the way from very near the surface of the star to the very bottom of the envelope, where you're in very close proximity to that neutron star core. This means that the star winds up hosting something called the interrupted rapid proton process. So what happens is you can imagine a packet of material moving around in this convective region that gets dragged down to near the base of the convective envelope and near the neutron star. In this region, the temperature and pressure are so extreme that we start pushing protons very rapidly onto the nuclei of atoms in that packet of material. So we start pushing these atoms up the periodic table. That material only stays down there for something like a hundredth of a second because the convective speeds in these stars are so incredibly fast. So it undergoes this proton bombardment for a while and then gets dragged out into a cooler, quieter part of the stellar envelope where it starts to undergo beta decay. Before it gets too far along that chain, it gets dragged back down and is bombarded by protons, and the whole process starts again. So this is hence the interrupted rapid proton process. It means that you wind up with really bizarre elements at the surface of the star. You see an extreme excess of molybdenum. You see an extreme excess of rubidium. Another process coming from the same stellar structure actually winds up building up a lot of extra lithium. So the way that you would want to find a star like this is to take spectra of a bunch of red supergiants and look for a star that's showing weird signs of excesses. So this was how we actually started the project. We'd been observing red supergiants for years. We grabbed a sample of the coldest and most interesting looking ones and went and got very high resolution spectra. So this was the spectrum of a red supergiant that I showed before. I'm now zooming in to the Echelle spectrograph resolution that we wound up using. And I've specifically zoomed in on the molybdenum, lithium, and rubidium lines in a normal red supergiant. So you can see that these lines are kind of unremarkable. Molybdenum you can barely find. And the lithium and rubidium lines are findable, but fairly unremarkable. We observed about 70 stars, and 69 of them looked like this. And in one of them, the spectrum looked like this. Molybdenum had gotten much stronger, the lithium line had gotten much stronger, and the rubidium line had gotten much stronger. We were analyzing all of these with respect to elements like nickel or iron that you wouldn't expect to see enhanced in a TZO versus a red supergiant. So from all of these observations, we've concluded that we found what looks like the first candidate for confirming that Thorne-Jitgov objects exist. So this is a sort of extreme carryover of what red supergiants and binaries might behave like, but it's an interesting piece of the puzzle. We now have a new way that stars can form. We have a new way for stellar binaries to evolve, and we have a new way of making things like molybdenum or lithium in the universe, which is always extremely valuable. So to finish off, I wanted to go back to the question I'd asked before of who cares about red supergiants, and I'd listed off all these potential applications. I want to zoom in on three of them briefly. And the first one is gravitational waves. We know that colliding neutron stars produce gravitational waves as of about 6 months ago. Neutron stars evolve from red supergiants in binaries. If something is a neutron star, it has almost certainly gone through a red supergiant phase at some point in its past. It has undergone red supergiant mass loss. It has interacted with a companion. Understanding how we go from that point to the neutron star that we're seeing produce a gravitational wave is really key if we want to learn more about these systems. Red supergiants are also supernova progenitors. They directly explode, and sometimes they're an intermediate step on the way to making supernovae. So red supergiants are one of only a couple types of stars that we've actually observationally confirmed die as supernovae. So this is a pre-supernova image of supernova 2008 BK. If you look at the location of the supernova before it happened, there's this nice red supergiant looking thing there. If we then go to a post-supernova image after the supernova's faded away, the star is gone. That star is clearly dead. So understanding these stars is first key for understanding these types of supernovae. They make a very particular type of supernova. If you plot the light curve of a red supergiant supernova, it makes what's called a type 2P supernova. We see the initial peak, and then as the light curve starts to decay, there is a temporary plateau. That plateau is coming from interaction of the supernova shock with the surrounding material that the red supergiant lost. A lot of times what we'll have is a pre-explosion image of something that we then try to drop on an HR diagram, and we use that to backsolve. We'll say, oh, there was a supernova progenitor that landed here. Oh, that looks sort of like a 15 solar mass-ish type star. I bet the star was 15 solar masses when it was alive. The problem comes from all the evolutionary tracks that I've showed you. If we account for mass loss, if we account for binary evolution, it becomes very hard to take one of these gray data points and say for sure whether it came from a 12 or 15 or 20 solar mass star. If we can refine tracks like this and refine what types of red supergiants they predict, that's going to really help our understanding of supernova progenitors. And then finally, strange and variable stars become interesting. Sorry, the last thing I want to mention. These stars are all presumed to have died as red supergiants, but remember, some of them turn into Wolf-Rayet stars. Some of them get hot before they die. So understanding the mass range of stars that do that and understanding the mass loss that dictates that also helps us understand supernovae that don't come from red supergiants, that come from more exotic stars that we still don't know nearly as much about. And then finally, strange and variable stars are really interesting. We know that red supergiants vary in their brightness. Their spectra also vary. So these are four spectroscopic observations of the same red supergiant from 2004, 2005, 2010, and 2013. Remember that those titanium oxide bands are very much a product of the temperature in the star's atmosphere. So according to these spectra, the star has gone from a 4,300 Kelvin star to a 3,500 Kelvin star to like a 3,800 Kelvin star to 3,650. Its temperature seems to be very dramatically changing. Now, we don't think that's exactly what's happening. We think what we're seeing are opacity effects in the star coming from very sporadic mass loss. But we still don't have a great explanation of why this star and others like it, because we have a whole sample of stars that do this, might behave this way. So we need to understand all of the different things that can cause a red supergiant to vary. And these include things like that large-scale surface convection that I showed, the whole star kind of boiling away. The stars will radially pulsate. Their radii will change with time. That will also change brightness. Changes in the amount of circumstellar dust will change the apparent brightness of the star and what the spectrum might look like. We know that they might be hydrostatically unstable. We know that these stars could have binary companions that are eclipsing or undergoing mass transfer, are interacting with the winds. And there's other sources of variability that I'm sure we haven't even touched on yet. So understanding how bright these stars are is obviously really key. This is how we find the stars in other galaxies. This is how we do all sorts of work with them. And we have to start by quantifying the different variations that we can even expect in a star like this. So last, what's next for red supergiants? There are upcoming space telescopes that will be focused on infrared observations. So this slide got a lot more depressing since I made it, but yeah, so the James Webb Space Telescope is due to be launched soon. It is optimized for infrared observations. WFIRST will hopefully be getting launched in the very near future and is also going to be an incredibly powerful and deep infrared telescope. Both of these are going to be amazing for studying local and extragalactic red supergiant populations. For one, we can use these to pre-image swaths of other galaxies and detect red supergiants that might soon explode as supernovae. So we've gotten lucky with a handful of supernovae and had pre-supernova imaging where we can see the red supergiant. With the power of these telescopes, we'll hopefully grow that list enormously. We'll also be able to use these to observe mass loss and dust production, since those are both very good mechanisms to observe in the infrared. The extremely large telescopes are going to be amazing tools for stellar astrophysics. So the Giant Magellan Telescope and the EELT in Chile, the 30-meter telescope in Hawaii, all of these are going to be good for spectra of extragalactic red supergiants. Right now, we can get spectra of individual stars slightly out beyond our own local group. These are going to be able to go much further and get those really detailed spectroscopic observations in very distant galaxies. This helps us understand the stellar populations, the metallicities of the stars, and even properties of the galaxies as a whole if we can start quantifying the stellar population. Their adaptive optics is also going to be amazing. You kind of can't find an image of all of these without getting at least one depiction of the multi-conjugate adaptive optics setup that they have. This is going to make it really interesting to image very distant red supergiant samples. So these in particular are pushing our studies of red supergiants out to very impressive distances. And then finally, there's the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So this is going to be bringing in a completely new era of transient astronomy. This is the 8.4-meter telescope being built in Chile that's going to image the entire available sky every 3 nights. That means that every star that varies, every star that disappears, or every star that goes supernova or changes in color is going to be detectable in that data. I think the number is that it gets something like 30 petabytes of data in a month or something. Like, just the numbers start to get ridiculous. But it's computationally challenging, but astronomically amazing, just because of the volume of varying stars that we're going to get. So it'll be great for observing red supergiant core collapse events. We've seen red supergiants that die as supernovae. We've even recently seen an example of a red supergiant that seems to have suddenly disappeared. It did not produce a supernova, it just winked out. We don't know if that means that star directly collapsed to a black hole and hit that sweet spot where you can collapse to a black hole without a supernova, or if something else happened, but LSST is going to be amazing at finding more of them. It also lets us study variability in the stars. We can see how their colors change, which is a nice proxy for spectra. We can see how their photometry changes and try to suss out the difference between those different sources of variability. But all of that comes back to the enormous sample size that we're going to get with LSST.
Are you actually going to get the curves in the HR diagram? Because all of your points are at the end. You know, you have the long, flat, straight line.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to, I mean, that is quite a rapid phase.
It is.
But since you have so many, you might actually get a few on that.
It's a fantastic question. So LSST is going to be very powerful. It's not going to get extraordinarily deep into other galaxies. So what you're describing is getting a much larger sample of yellow supergiants. And they're simply just too rare. Like Polaris, funnily enough, is a yellow supergiant. It's one of the only ones that I can think of off the top of my head in our Milky Way. So the way to fill that in would be to do very deep surveys of other galaxies and try to look for yellow supergiants. I have collaborators that have done this, and it's actually awful because I talked about the red dwarfs that contaminate our sample. Those we can separate out with colors. Yellow dwarfs are impossible to clean out unless you have a very good understanding of that background galaxy's kinematics and you can use radial velocities to tell the difference. But eventually that's what we would want to do. And I mean, I'm sure LSST will at least help by confirmedly grabbing all of them that we can see, but you'd really want very deep extragalactic surveys to do that for sure. So just to wrap up, if you are convinced that you care about red supergiants and if you're fascinated in them and want to learn more about them, I'm going to do a plug for this, which is part of why I now have this talk. So I recently wrote a book on astrophysics of red supergiants, and this isn't a money grab because the book is free. It's an ebook available free from IOP if you have an institutional subscription. So you can just go to the website and download the book. It is really short. You can tell it's very small. It's only 100 pages. It was purposely tried to be kept succinct, and it's written at the level of an advanced astronomy grad student. So as a whole, it should give a complete primer on the current state of what we know about red supergiants, their physical properties, their populations, what we know about their mass loss and their binary evolution, and what the key questions are going forward. So if you're interested in red supergiants, this should hopefully serve as a kind of standing reference for answering any questions that you have. But in the meantime, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have right now. So thank you. Yeah.
So a small question. When you showed the diagram, mm-hmm. I didn't have like any idea of the time scale involved in this evolution. It's basically right now as a snapshot of something that takes millions of years to. So basically the time they spend could also affect like the sample that you get from observations, right?
Yes. So that HR diagram, these stars will spend 10-ish million years on the main sequence. They then cross very rapidly on the timescale of about 100,000 years, and then they spend a few million years as red supergiants. So yeah, we're seeing snapshots. And the problem here is that a lot of groups right now are interested in trying to very accurately measure the ages of stellar populations. This works really well for older populations of stars because you can look at something like where the turnoff is from the main sequence and the population of red giants. But massive stars move so rapidly and are so relatively rare, thanks to the initial mass function, that it's harder to estimate their population ages. This is something I'm really curious about because I would love to be able to grab a population and say, it is exactly this old. We should be able to see exactly these types of stars. And a couple of my students are actually working on related projects to that, but a really difficult thing is determining the age of a population. And by the way, how many populations there are. Because if you had a burst of star formation and then 5 million years later you had another burst, that very quickly complicates how you estimate the age. Other questions? Yeah.
So for the candidate Thorn...
TZO.
Candidate you mentioned, was the luminosity similar to that for these red supergiant stars, or was it different?
Very similar, and it's predicted to be very similar. So Kip Thorne and Anna Jitkov actually predicted two types of Thorne-Jitkov objects. They predicted giant and supergiant. And the supergiant versions are expected to be very comparable in luminosity.
But the mechanism, I mean, for the energy production is so different. So, like, why would it...
I think part of the issue is that you... In the supergiant TZOs, you have a small contribution from gravitational accretion onto that neutron star, but you're actually seeing a lot of thermonuclear processes in the base of the envelope that's also contributing to the luminosity. So yes, it is interesting that the luminosities happen to be very similar with a fuel source that's so different, but that is the prediction. You would also see dimmer versions of these that appear more like red giants. In those, gravitational accretion is a much stronger contributor. But the downside of that is that now we don't have interesting nucleosynthesis going on, so we no longer have a chemical fingerprint to look for. So the red giant versions become much harder to find. One thing we do expect, the luminosity itself is similar, but you would expect, kind of in the same way that you would expect for any cold massive star, to see some instabilities in the atmosphere. So when we got the spectrum of that star, something I didn't get the chance to show, let me see if I have it. If you look at the larger spectrum of that star, you see a normal-looking red supergiant spectrum with every Balmer line in emission, very strong, from H-alpha down to like H-13. And the ratio of the lines is also weird. H-delta is the strongest line, not H-alpha. We actually see this in the spectra of Mira variables. So these are lower mass red giants that are pulsationally unstable. And what we think this is coming from are shocks in a non-LTE atmosphere that are exciting these emission lines. So it stands to reason that something like a Thorne-Jitgov object would be pulsationally unstable. And if those pulsations are going on, you would expect to see that sort of emission. So that was a real surprise when we looked at it, but it fits with the Thorne-Jitgov object model. It's not quite a luminosity change, but it does also contribute to the model. The star itself is also ridiculously variable. Its brightness changes by like 5 magnitudes, but we see variable red supergiants too. So that on its own wouldn't have been enough for a diagnostic. But yeah, its name is a Harvard variable. It's one of the most variable stars in the Harvard variable catalog. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you preferentially find red supergiants in young open clusters?
Yes, very much, and exclusively, pretty much. In fact, that was one of our ideas for how to look for a Thorne-Jitgov object, because their lifetimes are hard to define, and how long they live depends on kind of who you ask and what you think is going to dictate their lifetime. If they puff themselves apart, they could be really short-lived, and these could be relatively rare and fleeting phases. If their lifetime is dictated by how long it takes that neutron star to accrete material and become a black hole, their lifetimes could be incredibly long, so you could wind up with something that looks like a red supergiant but has lived for billions rather than millions of years. And this is actually a project I'm pursuing with a couple people of looking for sort of odd, way too luminous to be an AGB star outliers in old clusters to see if we're coming across an old red supergiant. But the normal ones are only open clusters. Other questions?
When you label the stars on the diagram by mass, like how much mass loss is there along the evolution? And is that like the initial mass or the mass you observe it at?
So we tend to label all of them by their initial mass just for simplicity's sake, but they lose a substantial amount of mass over the course of their lifetime, especially depending on which phase you're looking at and what you're assuming about the star. So something that started as a 20 or 25 solar mass star may only have 4 or 5 solar masses left by the time it dies. Some of that will be lost through wind. Some of that could be lost through something like binary interaction. But for the most part, when you see us give a mass, we're talking about the amount of mass the star was born with.
And even as they're on the main sequence, do they lose much mass?
Not that much. A lot of it happens post-main sequence. There is going to be some amount of mass loss along the way driven by stellar winds. But stellar winds will get much more severe, and other mechanisms will start to come into play as the stars age.
So they don't really move down?
No, you'll actually see them slightly move up the main sequence. If you plot what's called the zero-age main sequence of where stars are sitting when they first start fusing hydrogen and the terminal-age main sequence, you would see the whole diagram kind of do this. You get an interesting spread of the width of the main sequence. This actually becomes an interesting diagnostic in its own right, but that spread comes from the mean molecular weight in the core slowly going up and the source of luminosity thus very slowly increasing. So during hydrogen fusion, they actually get brighter, not dimmer. Until you get down to very low masses where things get weird. Yeah. Yeah.
So probably a silly question, but there was this very exciting observation reported about a week ago of the first stars being in the universe being observed by this experiment in Australia.
Yes.
Now, presumably, mm-hmm. I could easily usually check, but are those stars much bigger than these supergiants?
So that's one of the guesses. So the trick of getting some of the first stars in the universe is that their metallicities are unbelievably low. And when you try to model a star that's made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium, you start modeling homogeneous evolution effectively. If you model their evolutionary tracks, they look completely different. They leave the main sequence and go that way. They are predicted to have very large radii, but I don't know that that's the same reason. I don't know that it's just a direct effect of their chemistry so much as it's questions about what the IMF is like or what star formation is like when you're that chemically depleted. And people argue a great deal about what that actual radius should be or what that actual mass should be.
So to say it differently, do you know when the first red supergiants formed?
Oh, that's a great question.
Can it be determined? Is there a way of finding out?
I would actually guess, it depends on, I guess, what you define a red supergiant as, because we were most certainly going to have helium-fusing stars very early on. The very first stars that form are going to switch to forming helium. I can't see a reason why they wouldn't get red, why they wouldn't also hold constant luminosity and then get cold. I would imagine that their spectra look very interesting and that their Hayashi limit might be at a very restrictive place on the HR diagram. So they might not be red in the same way that our Milky Way supergiants are red. But you should see a star cool off and hit this evolutionary phase, even if it's in the very first generation of stars.
I'll ask another question about the Thorin-Chanhope object.
Yeah.
It's described as a cannon.
Yep.
What observations would you need to make to be 100% sure?
It's a really good question. Ideally, we crawl inside and see the neutron star. But it's a great question, because we're trying to be very cautious with this detection. It's one of those cases where extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and we have three spectral lines and some emission lines and a couple other chemical oddities. I've talked to people about these ideas, and one idea would be to look for some sort of magnetic field signature in the star. This is difficult to do in red supergiants, but not impossible. Another idea would be to try and do astroseismology on the star. Astroseismology is the best way of actually digging into a star and figuring out what's going on. We're great at this in the sun. We're pretty good at this with red giants. It's almost impossible with massive stars, period, and especially with red supergiants, because what it requires is having a really good understanding of the light curve and knowing exactly where every little tiny variation in brightness comes from. You want to be able to say, oh, that variation is coming from the star radially pulsating, we're seeing a P wave from the star, and we can use that to figure out what's going on in the interior. So that, I think, would be the holy grail of observation that we'd eventually get. But we have an immense amount of work to do on normal red supergiants first, so that we can tell the difference between seismology of a normal star and seismology of a star with a neutron star in the middle.
Right, if there are no more questions, let's thank Emily again for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.